Okay. So shall we start? So good afternoon, everyone. It's really a pleasure to organize once again this event with Nicel. Thank you, Anya, for collaborating. And today, it's my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Adelina Rodriguez Sanchez, the Instituto de Ciencias Sociales, the Universidad de Lisboa, who is going to talk about, her book, recently published in the book series of Ravage of Political Parties on Party System Institutionalization in Africa. Basically, her thesis. She has also, published, in journals, like Politica, Electoral Studies more recently. And, we are very happy that you're here with us to share your thoughts about such an unknown, content. Thank you very much, Adelina. The floor is yours.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. And it's, of course, a pleasure for me to be here today and to talk about my research that started during my PhD and has now developed into a book on party system institutionalization in Africa. So thank you so much for attending, and I hope we have a lively discussion of the presentation. So, of course, the title of the seminar is one, but this is actually just a great gateway for me to actually speak about my book. So, in this book, I basically deal with three main questions, and I also try to use different methods and different sources of data to actually research these three questions. I implement a mixed method, because there's also multi-method research, but it's all the same, mixed method research design, in which I have collapsed the first two research questions in a quantitative strand, and then I continued with a more qualitative strand in which I have looked at the third research question. And which questions are these? So the first question I wanted to address is how to measure institutionalization, and in this case, party system institutionalization, PSI. And then I wanted to explain the different patterns of PSI across countries and time. And finally, I also wanted to say something about the mechanisms that were underlying such variation that I was expecting to find. And of course, prior studies had already raised the expectation that we could find variation in terms of institutionalization. So I wanted to explore both the causes and the mechanisms of institutionalization. And the first two research questions were within the quantitative part of my study, and the third question in the qualitative part of my study. And of course, institutionalization is the core concept of this book, and it is a quasi-fuzzy concept. So as in social science, we work with with concepts that are really difficult to measure, and there is a lot of controversy. And institutionalization has been measured both by attitudinal and structural elements. So the seminal definitions of institutionalization see it as the process by which institutions or procedures acquire value and stability, so both an attitudinal element and a structural one. And this has mainly, this is more or less of a conventional way of measuring of defining institutionalization. But of course, when we go from conceptualizing to actually measuring institutionalization with concrete indicators, there has been a plethora of models and ways in which institutionalization has been measured. For me, it interested me to look at party systems and not parties. And of course, in the literature, you will find, and if you are interested in institutionalization, you will find that this concept has been used either in the context of parties, party systems, legislatures, and so there's regardless of the aggregating level, you will find this concept being used. And sometimes in some studies, they try to separate the systemic part from the individual part, but in other studies, they collapse both the individual level and the systemic level within the same definition. So for me, I had to deal with, once I decided I was using institutionalization as a parameter for studying party systems in Africa, I had to make choices on whether I wanted to measure both the attitudinal and the structural element of institutionalization, which was conceptualized as such, but I also had to think on whether I was going, my units of observation were parties or party systems. So my choice was to study party systems, and in terms of the definition itself, I was more interested in the structural part of institutionalization. It is perhaps the most studied element of institutionalization, and it was also the element which I could measure, I would say, better with the data that I had. So it was not only a substantive issue, but it also had to do with the data that I had and how well I could measure this dimension. So this was part of the first dilemma into studying party system institutionalization and into applying this concept to the African continent. And so what I did was to follow from this debate, and then to which, I mean, Huntington, Mainwaring, and Scully, Levitsky, Randall, and Swazen, they discuss all of this in their studies. But I decided to add to the discussion from a different perspective too. So in my first research question on how to measure institutionalization, theoretically, I was assuming that institutionalization was a multidimensional concept, no different from Huntington, from Mainwaring and Scully and others. But I was assuming a twofold variance, not only in terms of the degree of institutionalization that a certain party system can display in a certain point in time, but also as a quality of institutionalization. So I was assuming that party systems can be ranked not only in terms of how institutionalized they are, and we can have a highly institutionalized party system such as Tanzania or Mozambique, but we could have a different type of institutionalization depending on how, on whether the institutionalization is followed by political participation or democratization. So I was trying to discuss this idea that it's not new. Huntington and others during the 70s discussed this idea of the different ratios between institutionalization, democratization, and political participation. And for me, I also wanted to bring a bit of that discussion into my analysis too, because in most countries across Africa, institutionalization is not paired with full democratization or political participation. So this qualitative content for me was really meaningful for my study, and particularly given the circumstances of my case selection. So for this first research question, I was mainly looking at this conceptual dimension of institutionalization. And what I did in terms of indicators, of course, I went again into the literature and I tried to see what were the indicators that would better allow me to measure institutionalization as a structural phenomenon. So I went to the literature and I was able to draw inspiration on works of Mary Wellesley, Mainwaring and Scully, and other studies. And of course, I tried to create this multidimensional measure for party system institutionalization, collapsing 11 indicators into these three dimensions. So the first two dimensions, for those of you that are a bit familiar with this, with studies on party system institutionalization, the first two dimensions are have been put forward by Mainwaring and Scully. So it's part of their framework of analysis. I have different indicators though, some new, some like alternation in government and serif sheets for the most voted party. And then stable roots in society, which try to measure whether parties that were formed in prior historical periods still hold a considerable serif sheets in the present, So this is a way of measuring stableness in society, whereas the first dimension tries to capture how stable are interactions between parties. And the third dimension that I have is organizational continuity. So this is a concept that was first developed by Kenneth Chandler. And then what I did was I tried to draw some inspiration from his indicator, but tried to measure how much the splits and the mergers were able to actually change something at the systemic level. So in terms of the measurement process, all indicators were computed on the basis of electoral data, and then I had transformed them using Mainwaring and Scully's measurement process. Of course, it's not perfect, but since it is the same that has been used in other studies that also analyzed African party systems, I wanted to keep some parts of my index coherent so that the results could travel to a certain extent. And I could compare my findings to prior studies. So since, due to these reasons, I have applied this ordinal scale to try and aggregate these differences and the scores of within each indicator. So this is basically my decision to measure institutionalization as a quantitative phenomenon. So with these indicators, I could say that at a certain point in time, a party system is institutionalized or not, as a degree that you can measure as a metric. But I also wanted to measure the quality of institutionalization. So for this exercise, I was testing the possibility that three particular outcomes were possible. So I was testing the possibility that we could find cases of adequate institutionalization in which political participation and democratic principles are matched by the growth of political institutions. So high levels of institutionalization plus high democratic standards and high political participation. But then we could have a case of over-institutionalization in which we would still have high levels of institutionalization, but then in terms of democratic performance and political participation, this regime would fall short in terms of attaining those objectives. And finally, inadequate institutionalization would apply to cases where party systems are too weak to actually channel the continuous flows of participation and at the same time pursue democratic tasks. So these were the configurations between institutionalization and other political changes in society that I was trying to measure. So for this first research question, and given these theoretical decisions, I had a sample of 30 sub-Saharan African cases. These were countries that had consecutive and competitive lower house elections. And I have observed some of these countries since 1966. Of course, this is to include places such as Botswana, Mauritius, which have been all the multi-party elections since the start since independence. And so, but of course, not all countries are observed since the 60s. The bulk majority of countries are observed from the 90s when the democratic tide hit Africa. So the gross majority of countries are observed from the 90s onwards. Okay? And then my main data was, of course, election data. In, I would say, 90% of the cases, I could use lower house election data, but at least for a few cases and elections, like Mali, Comoros, and Madagascar, I had to use presidential election data to compute some of the indicators. But of course, in the past during my PhD thesis, I decided not to include those cases because I didn't have the data. But this time, I decided to include them with the information that this I used presidential elections instead of lower house elections data. So what about some results? So those three dimensions that I presented earlier, and all those indicators were computed in terms of their original scores. And in my book, I have graphs portraying the results for each country and each indicator. But then in the end, I collapse all the indicators into an index of institutionalization. And this has allowed me to see that countries like Namibia, Cape Verde, Mozambique, and Botswana have the highest levels of institutionalization. So these are the cases where change is more limited. You will find lower levels of volatility. New parties have face higher thresholds to actually reach government. You will find that mergers and splits don't have much of an impact, even when they occur. They do not change substantively the patterns of competition. So there's not too much to win in those situations for those parties that actually decide to join a new political party or actually to split away from an existing party. They do not gain much in doing that. Also, I find that it is also in these countries that the oldest parties still retain the largest amount of seats. In the opposite side of the graph, we can see cases like Comoros, Mali, Benin, Liberia, Kenya, Madagascar, Malawi, Gabon, Niger, Zambia, Lesotho, and other cases where, in fact, you represent cases at lower levels of institutionalization. So in these cases, you will find change being more of a constant. From one election to the other, sometimes you don't know what the election will result on. And then in these cases, you will see mergers and splitting political groups actually having a chance to reach parliament and sometimes the government. If you think about Zambia, it's a clear example of that, with the PF being in power. PF is an offshoot of a former incumbent party, MND, and it has been in power since 2011, and still in other countries like Mali or Comoros, we do find a lot of fluidity in the way political parties rise and fall. And so in one side of this graph, we have these very stable party systems where change is confined to familiar competitors. And then in the other side of this graph, we find cases where parties just rise and fall more easily, and patterns of competition are more unstable. So, of course, there's a lot of diversity in the middle in terms of party system institutionalization, but this is basically my main result. And, of course, these are aggregate values for the period of observation of each country, but there's variation across years that is not presented here.
I think one country is pretty good. Just elaborate a little bit on how you apply this.
Yeah, I have case studies too, which will also help. But just go ahead.
It might not be the country you want to be.
Yeah, okay.
But say a country like Uganda.
Okay, we didn't talk about
it. It's quite representative, it's similar to other countries like Ghana, where there's two issues. Mm-hmm. Well, one big issue in Uganda is technically, under most of the period since Museveni came to power, mm-hmm. there was no parliament.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, but there was parliament still had a role. There were local elections, there were parliamentary mm-hmm. elections. Parliamentarians didn't have a function, but it was not a party system based on it, mm-hmm. even though sometimes there might notionally be mm-hmm. a party. And it was very separate from the president. And also, like many of the countries, mm-hmm. Mm. Not very much is gained by looking at party systems mm. prior to 1986 in Uganda mm. or prior to roughly mm. the mid-80s in yeah. any of these countries.
Of course. Mm.
For those countries, are you just looking at it since?
Yeah, since they became. Yes, itself? That's a very good point, because for Uganda, they had this referendum, I don't remember, it was in the early 2000s to actually. Install a multi-party system, because they didn't have partisan elections. You're absolutely right, in the past. But now they have, and I think I have included only the two most recent elections. So although I have this large 1996 to 2016, some cases it is possible to observe throughout this period, like Botswana and even Mauritius, but for other cases like Uganda and even Nigeria, which I only observed from 1999 onwards. So there are differences. So this is a very unbalanced time series cross-sectional data set. It's very imbalanced, because I do not have the same amount of observations and the same I've not included the same number of elections per country. I wanted to include countries that somehow had multi-party elections, and at least two concurrent multi-party elections. That way I could see some change. In the case of Uganda, I have included the most recent elections, and I couldn't use the prior ones. And in some of these cases, too. So I was looking at the context. So I could really include the cases that really were in that could fit my criteria. So yes, that's
just a related one. So that mm-hmm. when you're talking about mm-hmm. an organization or institutional mm-hmm. continuity, mm-hmm. in some cases, in many of the cases, there may have been an institutional identity well before any part of the established. So when would you? When you're trying to construct this measure, mm-hmm. do you take that into account? Or can you take that
yes.
into account?
So this is a very, I want to say, so this is a very, it's a very rough measure. So what I did, I counted the number of mergers and splits. And then on the basis of that number, I was trying to find the difference that these mergers and splits make in terms of changing, in terms of the number of votes and seats that they gather. So the higher the level of votes and seats that these merging and splitting groups get, I would assume that the higher the level, the lower is the institutionalization. So I was merely looking at this internal dynamics of whether party systems would exhibit some internal organizational continuity. This would mean that if they are organizationally, this is a concept of Kenneth Chanda. It's not just to say that my idea, but I think it's a very good one because it helps to show whether a party has been cohesive over time or whether it has been affected by different events such as splits and mergers. So I was mainly looking at this dimension. Of course, I'm aware that there are other issues, more ideological or identitarian issues, but these I couldn't measure with my data. But of course, they really make sense.
Sorry, I'm just not sure what you're trying to measure in terms of the organization. Can you just say a bit more about how that relates to what you mean by the
SI? So, in terms of institutionalization can be measured by several dimensions. So you can look at at stable patterns of how if competition between parties is stable. You can also look to whether parties are entrenched in society. But one other dimension that you can also look is whether because in the original model. Of Mainwaring and Scully, they included party organizations as an indicator of institutionalization. So they would argue that strong party organizations are a key requirement for an institutionalized party system. And so the criticism that arises is that, of course, it was that the dimension was measuring party instead of system level differences. And impact. And so in my study, I still wanted to have this organizational dimension that would say something about the ability of parties to actually have this this continuity as a unitarian party that has internal cohesiveness and whether this would make a difference in the way party system, in the way party systems develop. And so where you see a lot of political parties splitting and breaking away from existing parties, you may think, okay, so these parties would be unable to create, this party system would be unable to create an institutionalized party system because there are so many breaks and splits and factionalism and parties that disappear and merge to other parties. So you could argue that where this is happening, it's very unlikely that the highly institutionalized party system will appear. So I wanted to include this as a way to to capture some of this dynamic, because in the African continent, it's often said that there is a lot of factionalism in politics, and there's a lot of elite circulation. So for me to be able to say something about these dynamics, or whether they have a strong weight in party system institutionalization, this is something I think was relevant. And of course, I was following, a debate that was initiated some decades ago on why we should look at this organizational dimension. Of course, this is also present in May Merriam-Scully's framework, original framework, and I was just trying to convert this idea to a more systemic indicator that could tell me something on whether these mergers and splits make a difference in terms of institutionalization.
Can I just ask for a bit of understanding? Yeah. If you have a country with one party, which is basically one party state, mm-hmm. that would show up as highly institutionalized party system, mm-hmm. so there's no normative claim as which one is better, the highly institutionalized or lower?
Let me see if I understood your question. So you said that in many countries that are highly institutionalized, there's also a strong party.
No, it's the other way around that question, I think. So if you have a country with a dominant party, mm-hmm. that will show up as a highly institutionalized system.
Yes, in most cases, you will find that the countries that are more highly institutionalized are the countries with have lower number of parties. And usually where there is this strong party that can actually structure the competition structure. So this may lead us perhaps to wonder whether institutionalization really needs a strong political party. And this is something I discussed with the case studies, whether institutionalization actually needs a strong authoritarian party that can actually promote institutionalization in the future. But some of my data goes in that direction. So in highly institutionalized party systems are the ones in which very few parties were able to structure the competition. Yes.
Sorry, because I mean, it's just so important that we understand the indicator. Mm-hmm. Just to kind of follow up a bit on this discussion, was there like a decision criteria when to start collecting data? Because, mm-hmm. Like you would say, maybe a system that has only one party, mm-hmm. yeah, maybe that shouldn't count. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so the question of like, when is the starting point and what is the decision criteria for starting including the country into your measure, because it does seem mm-hmm. to be quite important.
So yes, I started collecting the data since liberalizing reforms were introduced, allowing for the organization of multi-party elections. So all countries fulfilled to this criteria. So all countries, yes. So one party authoritarian regimes. Well, I didn't. So all countries that I've included in my study are all somehow countries that transition to some form of democracy in the early 90s or others in the past. That doesn't mean that even during the democratic period, that you don't have patterns of one party dominance. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't.
One party regime wouldn't be excluded because mm-hmm. it's not.
Botswana, well, Uganda, plus by this dominant one party systems, even though you have set rights.
Yes. Yeah. So one thing doesn't deny the other. So one of the main trends of party system development in Africa has been that, in fact, you have had this process of introducing multi-party elections, and in some cases, it didn't have to turn over. So the same party stood in power. And of course, when I looked at this data in 2011, I had seen less changes that I've seen now that I had to update up until 2016. So the cases where no turnout has happened are really diminishing. So this is also interesting. And plus, there's more difference in there. And of course, we could have different types of this manifestation of one party dominance, but that doesn't mean that they are all the same. So they vary in the degree of institutionalization. So this is also something that I was trying to say. You can look at the party system and count the number of relevant parties, but this will tell you one part of the story. You can look at the African scenario and say, okay, most elections have resulted in one-party dominance, but there are differences in the way which party system is institutionalized, resulting from the different strains between political parties. So this is something also that why looking at institutionalization, because in this situation, it actually will help you find the differences that you somehow, if you only say these are all dominant parties or Uganda and Botswana are dominant parties, but there are differences between them in terms of party system institutionalization. And this is part of why I also decided to use institutionalization instead of other indicators to study party systems. Yes. Thank you for the questions. If you want, we can continue with the...
Because
sometimes all of this is in my head, but I'm not conveying. So, thanks for the question. It helps me to... Yeah. So now that I finally was able to explain myself properly as to how when I started to observe my countries and how I have completed my indicators and then come up with this this index of institutionalization. So then this gave me, of course, a metric of variation in terms of the indicators that I have computed for all these countries, and then I was trying to see whether we could find differences in terms of the quality of institutionalization. What could be the possible combinations between institutionalization, democratization, and participation? And for this, I did a cluster analysis. And with the cluster analysis, I was trying to see how all these indicators, institutionalization, electoral participation, and quality of democracy, whether these indicators would actually confirm my theoretical expectations, and my expectations were that we could find three types of qualities of institutionalization in the African sample: adequate institutionalization, inadequate institutionalization, and over-institutionalization. So in this second part of trying to reply to my first research question, I was actually looking at how this cluster analysis would work in terms of giving me this outcome. So the cluster analysis gave me some results. Some countries fit better than other countries, but still, most countries still conform to my expectations. So we can see in the sample of adequate institutionalized countries, party systems, countries like Botswana, Cape Verde, Mauritius, Namibia, São Tomé and Príncipe, Seychelles, South Africa, Senegal, which are most of them, with the partial exclusion of Seychelles, the most example democracies in Africa. So these are party systems that somehow are able to combine high levels of institutionalization with democratization tasks and some level of political participation. On the opposite side, we have over-institutionalized party systems in which we do have one-party dominance, but we also have high levels of institutionalization. But in these cases, levels of political participation are lower, and so are democratic standards. Finally, in the middle, there are these cases of inadequate institutionalization with highly or weakly institutionalized party systems that, of course, are unable to channel this demand of political participation and to further promote democratization. So I found some, in most cases, I found this framework and these qualities of PSI to actually being represented in my data. So, and one of the things I also found interesting is that, of course, in most African countries, party systems are facing dilemmas for institutionalization, either because you have cases where the parties receive an overwhelming mandate of power, and then the only way in which they can continue in power is to resort to coercion, or other cases where you do have a very weak party system that is actually unable to carry out democratic tasks and encourage participation.
What criteria did you use to allocate countries to each of those countries?
I did a cluster analysis with these three indicators of democratization, my index of party system institutionalization, and levels of turnout. And the cluster analysis
gave me three groups.
Yes, gave me three groups.
But that's not quite the same thing as saying each as then identifying those groups as adequate, inadequate, or over institute, because you have had some indication of that.
Yeah, so in my book I discuss how I was expecting that this framework, I theorize a bit on this framework, on this idea that there are different ratios between democratization and political participation and the strength of political institutions. So I theorize this, and then I try to find indicators that actually reflect this debate of how institutionalization can be paired with other political with relevant political processes that are happening in society. So the most relevant ones in terms of the theoretical discussion and also the cases were, again, electoral participation and democratization. And this is how I came up with this. Then I conducted the cluster analysis, which gave me the solution that, and by analyzing it, I was having I was trying to see whether these clusters actually conform to the theoretical expectation. And most of the countries do conform to the theoretical discussion. It's just that sometimes some cases are not as perfect as they are, because cluster analysis, of course, they cannot, there's always a margin of error and perfection. And in the case of Seychelles, for instance, it's not as democratic as the other countries in the clusters. But if we combine the average means of the cluster, Seychelles is actually closer to the adequate institutionalization than to the over-institutionalization. And I also discussed this a bit also in the book to show that, in fact, cluster analysis try to provide this clusters of what is happening in a set of cases. But of course, some countries do fit more the story of that I was trying to explain in terms in the theoretical part of my book. But other cases fail to be so precise. But yeah.
Sorry, just can you give an idea of the sort of electoral participation, so on the turnout? So what is the sort of average turnout among the other groups who are institutionalized?
Okay, let me just go here because I don't have these numbers. I have it here. So for the highly institutionalized, you will have, just trying to locate the page number. Okay, let's see. So for the highly institutionalized, for cluster number one, which is the adequate institutionalization, you would have on average a 28.3 score of institutionalization. The turnout would be around 70%. And in terms of democracy, I use the Freedom House scores, which I know I'm not very good. Then Freedom House score is the best democratic score. So these are cases where institutionalization is high, turnout is high, and democratic performance is high. So, and this fits almost all the cases in this cluster, with the partial exception of Seychelles. And then we have the second case of inadequate institutionalization. So here, the average leverage of institutionalization is 21, and participation turnout is 60%, and the levels of democracy are 1 point. I can say the value because it won't mean nothing, but it's a bit lower than the first group. So in this case, we have the lowest levels of party system institutionalization combined with with more or less average levels of turnout and of democratic performance. Whereas in the last group, we had high levels of party system institutionalization, 27, and then 50% of turnout, 59% of turnout, and then the lowest democratic scores. So the last group still has high levels of institutionalization, but it has, in terms of turnout, lower levels of turnout and the lowest democratic scores. So it means that this institutionalization has been occurring at the expense of democratic improvement and at the expense of participation. Whereas in the first case, we do see a more, in the first cluster, we do find a more balanced situation between the three processes. And in the cluster of inadequate institutionalization, we find something a bit different, because party system institutionalization has the lowest score there. So this is where party systems are more unable to actually channel participation and promote democratization. Thank you for the questions. So I will continue in this part. So this was also the first research question in my book.
Thank you.
But I prefer. It's just that I only talked about my first research question, but it was great to have this opportunity to discuss more of this part, which was for me perhaps the most difficult one in terms of data collection, making sense of the data. So thank you for your question, of course. So for the second research question, I was trying to argue that the differences that we can observe in levels of party system institutionalization could be explained on the basis of three main explanatory accounts. So first, I was testing the idea that the mode of transition to democratic or to hybrid regime would explain why some party systems became more institutionalized than others, the design of political institutions too, and the framework of party citizen linkages. So I was testing this idea that in terms of the party citizen linkages, that where parties convey more of a programmatic appeal, maybe in those countries, then party systems would be more institutionalized, because programmatic linkages tend to promote more stable and durable partisan ties. So this would, if this matters, then it would impact positively on institutionalization. In terms of the design of political institutions, there's a lot of mixed findings when we look at the effects of electoral systems or even presidential regimes on institutionalization that actually contradict some of the findings that have been, or some of the theoretical expectations on this. And so for me, I was trying to look at these three explanatory questions in light, of course, of explanatory accounts, in light, of course, of much of the debate on what explains party system development in Africa. For instance, there's this idea that it was two great books that actually have one from Rachel Riddle and the other one from Adrienne Lubat, where they argue that how the prior, that much of what explains present party systems in Africa has to do with the prior authoritarian regime. So in the view of Rachel Riddle, where the former authoritarian party was able to actually build support on and incorporate local elites into the state, in those cases, then they would have been able to garner much support that would be valid during the transition and then help them in the future institutionalize the party system. Whereas, for instance, Adrienne Lubat says something a bit different. She says that where the state was able to coexist or to allow the existence of this labor organization or other types of organizations, then these organizations would be like the starting points for the formation of political parties, and this would in the end also affect how party systems would develop. So both these accounts, both these explanations are looking at the authoritarian legacies. And for me, I wanted to focus on the transition moment, because during this transition setting, a lot happens. Political actors have to make decisions, and the incumbent authoritarian party will lose the monopoly of power in some cases. In others, it didn't happen. But this is a period of high uncertainty. So this was also a bit of a black box, which I wanted to explore to see whether different types of transitions would have a different impact on party system institutionalization. And I was testing this idea that where that transitions that had the highest level of protest would be less institutionalized over time, because I was assuming that these types of transitions generate this legacy of more robust civil societies, but it will also, at the transition setting, create more incentives for party formation, because you have higher levels of higher aspirations of political participation, higher levels of protest, and this can actually be channeled into party formation. So, and in terms of the design of political institutions, I was my the additional institution that I was interested in besides the presidential, whether it is presidential or not, whether it is a majoritarian electoral system or not. I was also interested on party funding to see whether in countries where funding, public funding is wide and available, party systems are more institutionalized or not. And actually, I also confirmed that. So basically, with these three indicators, hypotheses I was testing, I was proposing this idea that institutionalization was this was not only the result of critical junctures, but the result of this continuous process of party building and continuous choices of political parties over the rules of the game. So these were basically, I was trying to create a more dynamic approach of party system institutionalization that could combine both the past and present challenges. Okay. You have the question? So you can make questions. So I have performed some statistical analysis using my index of party system institutionalization, and then I have collected several data to operationalize each of my variables, either the independent variables and control variables. And so this is the results of my. Since I run several models, I only present this summarizing table. I think I'll probably go to my case studies so you see a bit of my case studies. But I basically confirm my expectation that the higher the levels of protest during transition, then over time institutionalization tends to be lower. I also confirm that the higher the levels of public funding, the higher the level of institutionalization, and where there are higher bands on private funding, we do find the same effect. So more programmatic linkages tend to also lead to higher levels of institutionalization, but majoritarian electoral formulas tend to produce lower levels of institutionalization, and this is something that I discussed with the case study, but I also want to thank Fernando for giving me an idea to explore these results further, which I didn't do in the book, but I will probably think more about it. So,
before you go on to the
case study,
just one question on that.
Okay.
Why don't I see conflict in there? Because pre-transition regime and pre-openness, maybe that's not the big issue. The big issue could be whether the pre-transition was from, let's say, an autocracy like Jerry Rawlings, who introduced elections and then conveniently got elected as president, or Uganda or Mozambique or Angola or any of those cases where it's the victor in the civil war comes into power and then establishes a party and democracy. So whether the pre-transition regime was competent or not seems to be a crucial variable, but it's not there.
No, actually it's not there. I was looking at this Michael Bratton and Van de Velde classification of the prior authoritarian regime, in which they look at the levels participation and pluralism. So I was trying to find some positive legacies of democratization in the prior authoritarian period as a way to find a linkage to frame a more positive legacy in terms of party competition and party formation. So I was trying to look at that instead of looking at conflict, because somehow, since most of my cases for the period that I am analyzing, they did not experience conflict. For instance, I had a case of Nigeria, but I only observed from 1999 onwards. So since I was looking mainly at this period, I didn't look at conflict as a relevant explanatory variable in my models. So this is what I did.
And just a clarifying question: what is ethnicity?
Okay, I used Alexina, Alexina.
Yes,
yes. Yeah, yeah. In other studies, I've seen the Daniel Posner, in the other, which are very good as well, and they produce more or less the same type of finding that I think Rachel Riddle uses that one, and she arrives to similar conclusions that this prior positive that ethnicity or the expression of this politically relevant ethnic groups actually helps threaten the institutionalization. Okay, so for the third research question, I was trying to see whether all these results I was getting from the quantitative analysis, whether I could analyze them as and better explore some of the results with to specific case studies, and to go from the quantitative analysis to the more case study analysis. I was inspired by this idea of Tilly of thinking in terms of environmental mechanisms and relational mechanisms. So, for trying to apply this framework to my study, I was able to think in environmental mechanisms as all the surrounding environment, all that is changing, and that parties want to control as much as they can. So basically, for my analysis, I was looking at how the transition setting created all this potential for change, and how political parties during this environment, this changing environment, were trying to make the decisions that would shield them in the future. And also, I was trying to see which institutions they were actually choosing as a way to protect themselves and neutralize external challengers. So I was thinking this idea of environmental mechanism really speak to me, because it relates precisely to the way in which political parties are trying to exert boundary control, and to a meaning that they are trying to offset all types of challenges during this this changing periods. So in terms of relational mechanism, and let me just go back to say one thing. So in terms of the environmental mechanisms, I was thinking not only on the type of transition, which I included in my model, but I was thinking in terms of the actual choices of political institutions, such as the funding rules, which also matter in my model, the electoral system, and that's it. Yes. So I was looking at these two, which were also part of my model. So for environmental mechanisms, I was trying to see how the transition and the choice of these two particular political institutions affected the likelihood of party system institutionalization. In terms of relational mechanisms, I was looking at this connection between parties and citizens. And here, for me, it was interesting because one of my results has to do with how that suggests that parties that convey a more programmatic message tend to where more programmatic messages prevail, party systems tend to be more institutionalized. So I wanted to capture this connection between parties and citizens. So this would again cluster this idea of these relational mechanisms that capture the connections between parties and citizens, and which I have explored in the case studies. So I looked at three diverse case studies, very diverse, and they are diverse because each of them represents one type of institutionalization. So Cape Verde is a case of adequate institutionalization, Zambia a case of inadequate institutionalization, and Mozambique of over-institutionalization. And so I wanted to use these cases to exemplify each variety of institutionalization, and to go and to focus on those results, statistical results, that I found more interesting. So I was looking at the transition, at the choice of political institutions, and at the nature of participants and linkages. So to summarize my results in terms of the case study analysis. So the first question I wanted to address in this exercise was whether the incumbent controlled the boundaries of change during the transition from the authoritarian regime to to the new multi-party regime. So in the case of Kepler, there was this partial boundary control. So the incumbent authoritarian party, the PACV, was still a strong competitor during transition, but it was matched by the strength of an opposition party that emerged during transition and was able to level the negotiation agenda. So why was the PACV still a relevant competitor at the transition setting? So during the authoritarian era, the PACV was created this, the best strategy that the party used to build support was to promote this ideological and programmatic incorporation of political elites into the state. So by co-opting support of the local elites, it was able to remain strong. It had some basis of support until the transition period. And when the transition initiated, it initiated with slowly reforms led by the PACV. These reforms actually created enough space for the emergence of an opposition party that was actually able to also level the playing field. Now in Zambia, the transition mode was from below. There was an unprecedented level of protest in the country, and the UNIP, the former authoritarian party, during the authoritarian era, he opted for this clientelistic incorporation. So this meant in Zambia, the UNIP developed this state-led patronage and clientelism. And so when the economic crisis hit the country by the late 80s, all the sources of support disappeared because they were mainly clientele and not ideological and programmatic. And what I argue at this point is that those programmatic ways of incorporation, local elites, provide for stronger sources of support over the long run, and it's different because where the main strategy is a clientelistic incorporation, then over the long run, where we see that when the main source for building support disappears, then the party completely collapses. And during the transition, the UNIP had no control over the changing agenda. So it was completely surpassed by the potency of popular protest and by the new emerging political party. So in the case of Mozambique, we do find Frelimo's ability to actually control. Of course, this was a war to democracy transition, and there were international actors also intervening in the democratization and peace-building process. But Frelimo was during this period able to control as much as it could the boundaries of change, either changing its strategy from substituting local elites to incorporating local elites, either to pick in the right electoral systems and rules that would allow to divide and rule. So these were something that was really relevant in the case of Mozambique. So for this first part, an important message is that in the case of Cape Verde that has an adequate institutionalized party system, we can actually see that a strong opposition party is really relevant for the emergence of more adequate forms of institutionalization, because where you fail to, where political parties fail to actually remain cohesive, or where they receive this overwhelming mandate of power, they will resort to coercion to actually stay in power. And this has been the case of Zambia and Mozambique. In terms of the political institutions, from the way electoral systems were selected, so for instance, in Cape Verde and Mozambique, they have the proportional representation system with closed list ballots. And in this case, we have a system that actually promotes parties instead of personal aspirations. Plus, if candidates want to be placed in the party list, they really need to be loyal. So this also protects the parties of the system from defections and other things. And of course, in both these countries, we do have high levels high levels of stability in these party structures. So of course, in the opposition, there have been some episodes of splits, but the major parties have been cohesive political parties, and how they have regulated party funding and party registration has also helped to that. So in both countries, we have, and particularly in Cape Verde, we have very protective rules that actually shield the existing parties from new challengers. And this goes, it can include several things. So in Cape Verde, it's very difficult to, in order for political parties to register themselves, they have to collect, they have to sign this constituency act in all islands. And so it's very difficult and cost, and it's very expensive for them to actually run a campaign and even to travel across the country so that they could sign constituency acts in each of them. And plus there are several requirements that they have to include. So there are several ways, of course I'm not mentioning all, but there are several institutional devices that they use in order to make this process worse for newcomers. And in terms of party funding too, Cape Verde is the case in which there is high advance on private funding. This means that those parties that don't have access to public funding, most of them, and I've talked to some party leaders in those countries, they actually have to make a bank loan to run a campaign. And then if they don't get elected, then they have to pay the debt, and then sometimes they don't have the chance to run in the following election. But they do, some of these parties, they ended up competing in the most relevant constituency and then forgetting about the rest because it's really not possible for them to actually compete consistently in our constituency. So you can see how the rules are created really can undermine the opposition's chances. And so this was part of the thing that I was discussing in this effects of political institutions, and which I will not continue because I don't have time, but I would have examples also in Mozambique and Zambia of how this choice actually, in the case of Cape Verde, it promotes this centripetal competition, relatively low levels of fragmentation, and it actually shields the two major political parties and stability. And then you have the case of Zambia, where in fact you see this very centrifugal and polarized political competition, with constituencies being the main units of political competition, because you have the first past the post, and this incentivizes this directly linked with the constituencies. And then you have Mozambique, where in fact we have limited competition, low fragmentation levels, which tends to benefit the dominant party and stability for that purpose. So in terms of party, of the environmental mechanisms, I was looking at the nature of party-citizen linkages. Generally, I could highlight that in Cape Verde, we do find stronger and more stable connections between parties and citizens, and this could be seen with individual level data from the Afrobarometer, where I have looked at longitudinal data on trust on political parties and identification with political parties. But then on the party side, and when I was doing interviews, I was finding these mixed appeals to some ideology, but mainly to policy and programmatic content. And in Zambia, we do see a lot of shifts in parties' identities, in citizen identification with political parties, and we do see these changes following the incumbent government of the day. So there's a lot of fluidity there. In Mozambique, we do find this very strong, stable but unbalanced framework of citizen party citizen attachments. So basically, this would be like the main features of in terms of party citizen linkages. In most countries, when I asked about whether they would be able to position themselves in terms of left, right, or in terms of their main core message, ideological message, they would rather present programmatic content, but just dismissing the relevance of the ideologies. They would say, you know, justice, well-being for the people, eradicating poverty. This is what matters, is whether we stand on the left side or the right side, it doesn't really matter to people. They vote for policies and not for ideologies. So this is something interesting, because most of these labels don't apply to Africa, but it doesn't mean that policies are not being offered. It's just that the way that the traditional division these in terms of left right are not as salient as they are in other countries. So trying to end this presentation. So when I was doing this thesis and working on this book, several ideas were popping at the same time. Of course, I mean, you have then to fulfill the goal of writing a book with a particular focus. But I was looking at how this study really called my attention to how important it is to look at the transition, because there's a lot happening there. So during the transition, parties try something new strategies in terms of party building. They try to build support. They choose the old institutional outlook of the upcoming political system. Of course, in some cases they preserve the past ones, but there's negotiation and new parties that arise. How have some parties become so strong during this period? So we have to look at how the party building strategies happen during this transition period. So I also became interested to understand the levels of party and party system institutionalization in authoritarian regimes. Because not only in Africa, but across Asia, institutionalization is happening within a very autocratic political systems. So if you take the case of Angola or the case of Equatorial Guinea, you have these classic cases of authoritarianism, where there is high levels of institutionalization of a political party. So this would be something to explore in the future, and to perhaps to add to the literature on authoritarian survival. So another thing that was that I found interesting was to look at this supply side of how to look at political parties, and at the supply side, how do parties build support once they are in parliament? Because during campaign, during election time, they have some kind of. I will finish in 1 minute. So looking at this other side, how the parties build support once they are in parliament, which policies they approve, is there any difference in terms of how they frame their issues? And finally, I thought that maybe conducting cross-regional comparisons could be also a good way to actually see whether some of the patterns that I have observed in my cases would actually travel to other cases, to other regions or not. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. Yes, in one of your slides, you showed like a list of countries who are institutionalized or institutionalized. So what I've seen is that from previous research, Nigeria has been shown to be over institutionalized, but from what you showed, they were inadequately institutionalized, and I wanted to find out what's changed since then.
Nigeria has went through several phases of institutionalization. It has had a lot of instability, more or less up until 1999. So it has had the period of the coup right after the transition in 1993, and then it had a major transformation in terms of with the new drafting of the new constitution. And so since that starting point, it has now started to become more institutionalized. But I mean, this is more of a reflection of the of a 10-year story than when we look in a long-term perspective, of course. So this prior period could be one of more where you could see something different. But I think the system only now is actually evolving in a way that you could actually study as one of in which you can actually start measuring participatory institutionalization because you have consecutive elections happening. So also in the past, this wasn't much the case.
Thank you for your presentation. It's very good. I just have one question. I think it's linked to your second research question. In terms of drivers of PSI, I've actually read more from in Asia, and I think what comes to my mind is Alan Deakin's book.
Mm-hmm.
And in that book, obviously, one of the main explanations was the time and the timing when they become democratic or when they go through the transition. So have you considered that as an explanation?
Mm-hmm. Yes, in my controls, I have included a lot of dependent variables, so I could say whether the prevalence score of institutionalization explains the past score of institutionalization, explains the present score of institutionalization. Mm-hmm. I have included some time variables like the year since independence, the year since the first multi-party elections, so I could control the time issue in my estimations, yes. But that's a very good question because, yes, I did see when I was analyzing trends of institutionalization at the aggregate level, I was seeing that, in fact, it just goes, the most recent year, the scores have decreased slowly, but they have decreased a bit. So.
I'm not really working on this, but I'm very interested in democratization. So I wonder kind of what is the idea behind the interrelation between democratization and party system institutionalization? It's kind of what causes what, or how is, what's the dynamic between the two?
Mm-hmm.
That is, in a way, also party institutionalization and a characteristic of democracy establishing and consolidating, or does kind of democratization, cause this, right? And it was interesting to see that years since independence doesn't really, since independence, of course, so
mm-hmm.
it would be actually interesting to also, years since first election,
mm-hmm.
okay, sorry, that was one, that it doesn't seem to matter. So that was, maybe for next steps also, look much more into the kind of time dynamic and how these things go together, but just also to hear your thoughts and
So institutionalization, thank you for the question, of course. So institutionalization is often seen as a necessary but not sufficient condition for democratization. And although most studies tend to see or tend to show that there is this, most studies hypothesize that maybe there is this linear relationship with democracy, they also say that it is not always the case. And for instance, in this sample of cases, for me, I wasn't interested in testing the linear relationship, but I was trying to find some more qualitative and meaningful relationship between the different ratios that you can find. So I was looking more of a typology of relationships between democratization and institutionalization and political participation. So I was framing this more in terms of a typology. But of course, there's a link there, and many studies have studied this link, and different operationalizations of institutionalization have found a correlation in the African sample. They have found a positive correlation between certain institutionalization characteristics and democratization, thus suggesting that an institutionalized party system is beneficial for democracy. Yes. So there's this positive in the African sample of cases. They found some positive association between the two. Yeah. Yeah.
When you put up your metrics that you had all of the countries along, one thing that struck me is, if I was reading it correctly, your stable roots in society
mm-hmm.
seemed very low, if not zero, for most of the countries.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that just a property of the way you try to measure it,
mm-hmm.
or are you actually saying that somehow these parties emerged without roots in society?
Mm-hmm.
I would find that hard to believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in a certain, so this dimension, that's a very good question too. So this dimension, table within society, I measured it with three indicators. So I was looking at the age of political parties, whether they were founded up until the 60s, the 70s, or the 80s, and whether and how much and the amount of seats they had at each election. So basically, what the indicator, what the indicator reflects is how much is the number of seats the parties that you could see as historical parties are still able to win in present elections. So in some countries we do find that this is still high. In some countries we do find that historical parties have disappeared. So imagine the case of Zambia, where in fact the UNIP disappeared after 1996. And so it disappeared from the electoral arena. And imagine the case of Guinea-Bissau, where the PAGC actually was substituted in the first election, but then it came back to power. So all these dynamics eventually are captured by this measurement that I'm doing, because both these parties are parties that have been founded in the 60s. So in both these cases, these are just two examples to show how sometimes the values for some countries are missing, because in fact for some countries there are not changes in the way these all political parties have performed, and then in some cases you have like in Ghana you don't have parties formed in the 60s running in elections nowadays, or even in Mali. So this is also capturing this, the fact that some countries, these older political parties are not competing in present elections too. So they have disappeared, transformed into different parties.
It sounds like it's more a measurement issue than a we could go on for another hour talking discussing whether that's a valid way of trying to capture the roots in society.
Yeah, that's one possibility. There were other possibilities there, but I couldn't find the means to actually